This is episode 19 of the Nothing Human podcast, Joseph's Bones and Resurrection Trees.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. I'm Michael Minkoff. You're in for a little bit of a weird one today, although that's probably sort of a trend these days for me. This is episode 19, and today we're talking about Joseph's bones and the connection between bones and the resurrection, especially in the Old Testament. I mentioned this connection briefly in episode 16, but I'm going to talk about it in a little bit more detail today. Bones are a sign to me in the Bible of the lasting memory of a person in bodily form. So I think that the persistence of bones actually contradicts this Platonic idea that we have that grants the soul an everlasting or immortal quality, whereas we think of the body as this temporary and passing away type thing. And certainly the corrupt flesh is passing away, but as we talked about, the corrupt and dead soul is also passing away. But the body, as a memorial, persists in the bones, and our bones await the bodily resurrection and the reconciliation of all things and the glorification of creation that will occur at the end of time. So, both body and spirit ultimately are preserved in the Holy Spirit of God. Now, I know that's a lot, but I'm going to try to explain why I think what I think in this episode, and I hope you enjoy it. It would probably be helpful to listen to the last three episodes dealing with the material and the spiritual to give you some background on how I am viewing the body-soul union, but you can also start here and see what you make of it. You can find all the episodes of the Nothing Human podcast and my bonus podcast, Being Something Extra, on my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com. Please post your comments or thoughts there on my website on the relevant episode. I make a point of responding to every one of you as soon as I can. Also, do remember to follow, rate, and review on whatever podcast platform you use. That helps me a lot by getting this podcast in front of people that otherwise I wouldn't be able to access. So thank you very much, all of you, for doing that, and let's get into it. The author of Joshua closes his book with what might seem a curious anticlimax: the matter-of-fact burial of Joseph's bones and the death and burial of Eleazar the priest. This is in Joshua chapter 24, verses 32 through 33, which reads, "Now they buried the bones of Joseph, which the sons of Israel brought up from Egypt, at Shechem, in the piece of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money. And they became the inheritance of Joseph's sons. And Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him at Gibeah of Phinehas his son, which was given him in the hill country of Ephraim." The strange saga of Joseph's bones has raised quite a few questions. Why did Joseph put so much stock in a promised land burial? Why did his descendants think it important enough to remember it over the course and to the end of nearly 200 years? I mean, think about this. Moses and the Israelites carried Joseph's bones in a little ark when they crossed the sea on dry land. They carried him around with them in the wilderness for 40 years and then into battle camp in the conquest of Canaan. It's pretty strange. Now, I don't believe biblical authors mention anything to no purpose, and when they repeat things or place them in prominent places, we should take notice. Biblical authors mention Joseph's bones in three places in the Old Testament, in Genesis 50, Exodus 13, and Joshua 24. His bones are also mentioned in the New Testament in Hebrews 11. The remains of very few people, save Jesus, get more attention than that. But why are his bones given so much attention? A number of obstacles actually keep most readers from understanding the significance of Joseph's bones and burial. First, we have very little information on the specific nature and significance of Hebrew burial rites. We just don't know what they did, and it was so common to them, they didn't really think that they needed to tell us about it. And then adding to that confusion, contemporary modern Western burial rites have very little in common with apparently what they did in the ancient times. So we can't gain much from how we bury people now to give us some idea of why they did it the way they did it. And then probably the most important problem is that our Greek dualistic way of thinking tends to overlook the ancient emphasis on the unity of the person, and our contemporary individualism denies the unity of the community. And then the last reason is that contemporary readers cannot fathom the ancient Hebrew emphasis on the interwoven ideals of land, inheritance, and family name, and most readers tend to ignore geographical and cultural details in the biblical text because these details just frankly don't seem that relevant to us. So let's explore this stuff a bit, and I think this will be very rewarding in the end. So Joseph's burial is one of the clearest examples in the Bible of secondary burial, where family members deposit an excarnated skeleton into a family tomb. Excarnated means the flesh has been removed from the bones. We don't know the exact specifics of this practice, but usually a body was laid out on a rock slab in the family cave, wrapped in cloth soaked with oils and spices that would aid the decomposition process. The Egyptians actually had a sarcophagus with lime to eat away the flesh. That's actually the literal meaning of sarcophagus, is flesh eating, and for that reason, that was its purpose. You put the body in there once it died, and the lime would eat away the flesh. Anyway, in this ancient rite, after a period of mourning wherein the flesh would decompose and be eaten away, the family would return to the tomb to take the bones, now clean of flesh, and gather these bones into an ossuary, which was these cubby holes in the walls of the tomb or cave, which contained the bones of your ancestors, your fathers. And then you would be gathered to your fathers. And to be gathered to your fathers was literally to have your bones gathered next to or even mixed in with your ancestors' bones in that family tomb. If you want to know a cool word, this practice of depositing the bones in the family ossuary is known as ossilegium, which also happens to be the name of a Chicago-based black metal band, I kid you not. Now, Joseph's burial is not the only explicit example of secondary burial of the bones in the Bible, and this practice probably represented the norm in ancient Israel, even when bones, etzem, are not explicitly mentioned. Judging from archaeological evidence, it appears that ossilegium was quite common for many ancient peoples, especially in the ancient Near East. So, from the biblical, historical, and archaeological account, we see that secondary burial in the family tomb was the most honorable burial for any Israelite. They really took this seriously. Now, there were other less honorable ways for your remains to be disposed of, and I'm just going to list them out for you, ranked in order of honor. So honor number one was, like we said, burial in the old family tomb on your family land. Number two, burial in a new tomb of your family on other land that wasn't yours. Number three, burial in another family's tomb. Number four, being cast into a common or generic tomb. They actually called this the grave of the common people, literally the grave of the sons of the people. And then number five was non-burial, exposure of the corpse to wild beasts so that the flesh could be eaten by the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. That was really dishonorable. The worst, though, was when somebody maliciously exhumed your remains or willfully destroyed your remains. Burned them, crushed them, broke them in pieces. particularly your bones. That would have been considered just the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen. Now, why did the ancient Hebrews place so much emphasis on proper burial rites for their fathers and their kin? There are a number of possibilities. A lot of the ones that are forwarded by scholars are pretty silly, but here's one of them. Some scholars say the Hebrews believed dead family members spent time together in Sheol, the grave, only if their remains remained in close proximity. This idea of family members reuniting in Sheol, it really doesn't have very much biblical basis. It's not really a positive anyway. It's like, hey, we get to, what, be in some underworld? No, I don't know. Anyway, so if that's not the case, and I don't think it is, why was the honorable burial so very important, especially the preservation of the bones? Well, I think it's important first to remember, like we said before, that the ancient Hebrews weren't Greek in their philosophy of the body and the soul. They weren't really all that influenced by Greek dualism until about the first century AD, when Philo, a Hellenist Jew, and some of the others that followed him, tried to harmonize Greek philosophy with the Torah, with perhaps elegant, but I think very mixed results. Before that time, Jewish thought was decidedly not dualistic, and the body and the soul were viewed in union together. Eric Myers, in his article on secondary burials in Palestine, explains that, quote, "Hebrew thought knows nothing of mind-body dualism before the Hellenistic period, when the conception of immortality of the soul begins to leave its imprint on a substantial segment of Jewish literature. But the biblical conception of man as a unity holds sway until rabbinic times." Thank God. And I would say that the biblical conception of man should probably hold sway forever, but Myers' point stands nonetheless. Though the Bible makes distinctions between parts of a human being, these distinctions never become divisions, as we've said in previous episodes. If you're interested in checking that out, you should check out episodes 16, 17, and 18, where I talk about this stuff more explicitly. Now, for this reason, that there isn't a division between the body and soul, but rather a unity in them in the biblical conception, biblical authors tend to refer to humans representatively by any number of their constituent parts with the figure of speech that we usually call synecdoche. So this is where a part stands in as a representative of a whole, like when we use the word wheels to refer to a car, or boots on the ground to refer to deployed infantry. We're talking about a part of those things, we're using them to refer to the whole. So often, biblical writers employ the term soul or flesh in just this manner when they clearly mean to refer to the whole person. For example, all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth from Genesis 6, or the soul who sins will die from Ezekiel 18. Now, we do something similar, though we may not mean the same thing by it, when we say things like not a soul was stirring or no body was around. Now, one of the lesser considered synecdoches of identification in the Bible is the bones. The first time we see this term, bones, etzim in the Hebrew, Adam coins the famous biblical synecdoche of familial identity, where he talks about bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh in Genesis 2. Though hidden in most English translations, the word bone also appears commonly in a Hebrew idiom that literally means the bone of this or that day, usually translated this or that very day or self-same day. So the term bones, like flesh and soul, is often used synecdotally to refer to the whole thing or person, especially because of its connotations as the strength or core of a thing or a person. In other words, it wasn't just Joseph's bones that came back to Canaan. In a very real sense, in a very biblical sense, Joseph himself was brought out of Egypt to dwell in the Promised Land. Now, another biblical example of this same idea is found in Genesis 46, verses 3 and 4, where God promised Jacob, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you," singular, "up again, and Joseph will close your eyes." Now, we know that Jacob died in Egypt. It says it very clearly in Genesis 49 that that happened, and it also mentions that in Acts 7. So did God fail in his promise to Jacob when he told Jacob, "I'll bring you up," but Jacob actually died in Egypt? Of course the answer is no. The answer must lie in the fact that God brought Jacob's bones back up to Canaan, carried by Joseph and Jacob's other sons. And you can read about that in Genesis 50. Jacob's bones are Jacob. God fulfills his promise. Likewise, Joseph's bones are Joseph. And in his bones, Joseph actually possessed the land of his inheritance. And when Israel finished the conquest of Canaan, get this, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob also possessed that land their bones were buried in. So what God fulfilled towards Abraham's offspring, he really fulfilled toward Abraham. This must be so, or God didn't fulfill many promises he gave, actually, in the natural lives of the patriarchs. For instance, God promised Abraham to give Abraham the land of Canaan, not only his children. I mean, go read it in Genesis 17 and compare Genesis 28. He gave the promise to Abraham. Then he extends that same promise to Isaac in Genesis 26, and he gives the same promise to Jacob in Genesis 28. These land promises were not fully fulfilled directly to Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob in their lifetimes. So again, did God's promises then fail? Of course not. Again, in a real sense, the bones of the patriarchs possessed the land of promise. It wasn't just that the Israelites possessed the land as representatives of the patriarchs. And how do we know this? Well, because Moses and Aaron didn't have an inheritance in the land, even in their bones. Now, you might say, well, Moses and Aaron were Levites, so they didn't have an inheritance in the land anyway. But again, from what we just read in Joshua 24, we can see that Eleazar, the son of Aaron, who was a priest, was buried in the hill of Phinehas, his son, so they would still have enjoyed an honorable family tomb burial. But Moses and Aaron did not receive this honorable home burial because of their sins, as we read in Numbers 20. So if the patriarchs possessed the land merely through their own children, could we not say that Moses and Aaron then, quote, possess the land through their children? Perhaps in a sense, but in a more central sense, they did not. Because the thrust of God's censure of Moses and Aaron is that they themselves and the other unbelieving Israelites would not go into the land of promise to possess it. In fact, it says explicitly, the corpses of every one of the unbelieving Israelites fell in the wilderness. Their bones were in the wilderness. In other words, if the corpses, the bones of the unbelievers, had crossed over the Jordan, God's prohibitive oath to them would have been nullified. This also might give some explanation of why God buried Moses and didn't disclose the location of the tomb, since most likely the people would have, quote, honored Moses just as they honored Joseph by bringing his bones into the land of Canaan to possess it. So, though the children did fulfill the promise God made to the patriarchs, God also fulfilled that promise to the patriarchs themselves in their honorable burials in the land of their own inheritance. When the bones of the patriarchs rested in the land of promise, they themselves also entered into the rest of that land of promise, and they themselves inherited then the land their bones dwelled in, get this, forever, just as God had promised. Look it up. God promised they would dwell there forever. They had an everlasting possession of it in their lasting bones. Now, the authors of Scripture make a regular connection between land, inheritance, and your name or your memory. All three of these things draw together in your burial, since the most honorable burial was in your family tomb of the land of your inheritance that bore your father's name. Now, if you prove this point backwards, which you can, consider how many biblical texts connect disinheritance with non-burial or exhumation. You're like, I don't know. I've never heard of any of those texts. But there are actually a lot of texts about this particular issue, especially among the prophets of the exile, which makes sense, because not only were living Israelites dispossessed from the land in the exile, but even dead Israelites were dispossessed. A good representative case of this is in Isaiah 14, verses 19 through 20, where you have burial, remembrance or name, and inherited land intimately connected. So here's what Isaiah says. But you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain, who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial, because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be remembered forever. Now, one of the worst things that could occur to a person after death, and this is far worse than not even being buried, is to have your bones destroyed, especially by fire. And we see this not only from ancient sources, but from many biblical texts. For instance, in Amos 2, verse 1, God considers the burning of the Edomite king's bones, quote, to lime, as an unforgivable sin by the king of Moab. Deuteronomy 32 indicates that, quote, cutting a person in pieces connects to, quote, removing their memory from among men. And in Numbers 24, verses 8, the bones of the enemies of Israel are crushed in pieces. Josiah also, quote, purged Judah and Jerusalem entirely by burning the bones of the idolatrous priests on their idolatrous altars with their idols, which were considered the corpses of their gods. Now, curses and sin can also be in or on bones, which would render those bones unfit as honorable memorials. Consider Psalm 109, which contains some striking imprecations, praying that God would, quote, cut off a wicked man's children to blot out their name, as well as remember the sins of the man's parents to remove their memory. And finally, the wicked man himself seems designated to be blotted out, since, quote, curses have, quote, entered like oil into his bones. In Ezekiel 32, verse 7, a removal of the renown and legacy of the wicked is connected to, quote, punishment on their bones. Notice what he says here. He says, quote, nor do they lie beside the fallen heroes of the uncircumcised who went down to Sheol with their weapons of war and whose swords were laid under their heads. But the punishment for their iniquity rested on their bones, though the terror of these heroes was once in the land of the living. Now, on the other hand, it says that God, quote, keeps, or more likely watches over or guards, the bones of the righteous. Not one of them is broken. It's from Psalm 34, verse 21. Now, I cannot help but point out right now, in passing, that this psalm is quoted explicitly concerning Jesus' preserved bones in John 9, verses 33 through 36, where it says that his bones were not broken, in keeping and fulfilling this prophecy, apparently, from Psalm 34, which also refers to the unbroken bones of the Passover lamb, which we know that he is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So all of these things are connected, but I'm going to return to that connection a little bit later. These themes of inherited land, remembrance or memorial, and burial show up in a surprisingly significant way in the exilic prophets, as we mentioned. Of great importance, Jeremiah and Ezekiel both have visions involving exhumed bones, with some significant differences. Now, remember, Jeremiah preached to the faithless Israelites who remained behind in the land of promise after the Babylonian exile. These were the poor people that weren't considered important. They were left behind in the land of Israel. And ironically, they actually left the land against God's command and promise, and they left it to literally return to Egypt. And you can read about that in Jeremiah 42, like reversing the whole salvation story of the Exodus. Now, Ezekiel, unlike Jeremiah, who stayed with the Israelites, the few that were left behind after the Babylonian exile, Ezekiel, on the other hand, preached to the, quote, hard-headed Israelites who had already been disinherited from their land. They were actually, at this point, in exile. And so check out the difference between Jeremiah and Ezekiel's bone stories. So here's Jeremiah's less well-known, quote-unquote, Valley of the Bones vision. It begins like this. At that time, declares Yahweh, they will bring out the bones of the kings of Judah and the bones of its princes and the bones of the priests and the bones of the prophets and the bones of the inhabitants of Jerusalem from their graves. They will spread them out to the sun, the moon, and to all the host of heaven, which they have loved and which they have served and which they have gone after and which they have sought and which they have worshipped. They will not be gathered or buried. They will be as dung on the face of the ground, and death will be chosen rather than life by all the remnant that remains of this evil family that remains in all the places to which I have driven them, declares Yahweh of hosts. It's from Jeremiah 8, verses 1 through 3. Notice that these exhumed bones would be a great number, a host, but these bones have been disinterred not to life, but to death. These bones, similar to the exhumed and burned bones that Josiah burned during the restoration of Israel, have become intimately connected to idolatry and are therefore perpetually unclean. The honorable burials of the Judean elite have been reversed into shame. Judah has been effectively disinherited from the land, not only among the living by exile, but also among the dead by disinterment. Jeremiah comes back to this theme in chapter 16. For thus says Yahweh concerning the sons and daughters born in this place, and concerning their mothers who bear them and their fathers who beget them in this land, they will die of deadly diseases. They will not be lamented or buried. They will be as dung on the surface of the ground, and come to an end by sword and famine, and their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth. Both great men and small will die in this land. They will not be buried. They will not be lamented, nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Men will not break bread in mourning for them to comfort anyone for the dead, nor give them a cup of consolation to drink for anyone's father or mother. So I will hurl you out of this land into the land which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, and there you will serve other gods day and night, for I will grant you no favor. I will first doubly repay their iniquity and their sin, because they have polluted my land. They have filled my inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable idols and with their abominations. All right. Not exactly cheery stuff, but solid. Compare this passage in Jeremiah to Ezekiel's more famous Valley of the Dry Bones, which everybody knows about, I hope, and it's a very interesting connection. Ezekiel's host of bones also lie, you know, disinterred in a valley. They have not been properly buried in a family tomb. And perhaps they're fallen soldiers who have not been buried. These bones have experienced one of the most dishonorable of all burial conditions. Yet, these bones might very well belong to the soldiers of Gog, who eventually find a, quote, valley for a resting place and therefore an inheritance in Israel. You can read about that in Ezekiel 39. So Ezekiel's vision, when coupled with his contemporary Jeremiah's vision, indicates that even the dishonored dead of the uncircumcised nations can find an inheritance in Israel through God's compassion, whereas the honored dead of the circumcised and believing have been rejected by the land and by God. As Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 25 and 26 explains, "Behold, the days are coming, declares Yahweh, that I will punish all who are circumcised and yet uncircumcised, Egypt and Judah and Edom and the sons of Ammon and Moab and all those inhabiting the desert who clip the hair on their temples, for all the nations are uncircumcised and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised of heart." Now, you might be asking, what does honorable secondary burial have to do with circumcision? And I'm glad you asked. As we've discussed before, the bones of a person represent that person's core. And as we can see from Jeremiah and Ezekiel, this core can be honorable or dishonorable depending on the status of that person before God's covenantal favor. Now, it might come as a shock to contemporary readers, but many ancient Hebrews viewed honorable burial of one's excarnated bones as the final step in the purification of that person. It was sort of a sign of final and complete circumcision. Now, according to at least one scholar, this concept actually led to a really strange tradition among even pious Jews who would actually disfigure and ill-treat their bodies, like give orders for their bodies to be disfigured and ill-treated after their death in order to expiate for sins that they had committed during their lifetime. Now, though this practice might take the matter a little too far, good biblical reasons exist to equate the removal of, quote, sinful flesh with the purification of a person. In fact, biblical authors call the purifying rite of circumcision, quote, cutting off the flesh, literally the basar, the flesh. And it calls it that regularly, Genesis 17, when you first hear about this rite of circumcision concerning Abraham, and then Leviticus 12, it says cutting off the flesh. Further, incorrigibly unclean people themselves were, quote, cut off from Israel as mere flesh, which you can read in, again, Genesis 17, Leviticus 7, and Ezekiel 21. Interestingly, the worldwide flood represents the earliest extreme version of this cutting off of the flesh. You can read about it in Genesis 9. And this has led author Peter Lightheart to categorize the flood and circumcision together as different, quote, campaigns in God's, quote, war against and prosecution of flesh. But, Lightheart says, with circumcision, unlike the flood, God has committed to, quote, kill flesh without killing fleshly humans. Now, some evidence also exists for this reading of circumcision as purification of the flesh in the Septuagint, which translates a few less literal usages of circumcised as Greek purify. So this purifying removal of the flesh and circumcision becomes literally complete after burial when only the bones remain. That's really important to understand. So in some ways, excarnation becomes the final circumcision of a person in their process of purification. And what's left behind of them in the bones is actually the seed or the core of that person free from all corruption, which is one of the reasons why it's fitting, even in funeral eulogies, that you don't mention all the horrible things about a person, because in some ways, their flesh, their horrible parts, their corrupt parts, their decaying parts have been removed. Now, Passover in the Mosaic Covenant augments the circumcision of the flesh inaugurated in the Abrahamic Covenant. So the Mosaic Covenant is after the Abrahamic Covenant of circumcision, and Passover is sort of a deepening of that idea. The sacrificial laws mark a really deep totality of the war against flesh. Notice that even the bones, though, of the substitutionary Passover lamb were to remain preserved and unbroken. And all the flesh, however, was to be eaten. And it says that very explicitly. You can read in Exodus 12:46. It says explicitly, all the flesh had to be eaten. Not any of it was allowed to be left behind. But get this, because it gets really odd here. According to author Julian Morgenstern, the preservation of the bones likely ensured the possibility of resurrection. Now, this is what he says. Unquestionably, the same conception of the possibility of restoration of life so long as the bones are preserved underlies Ezekiel's vision and proves conclusively the existence of this belief in ancient Israel. Certainly, Ezekiel did not invent the picture, nor was he the first to conceive the idea. Possibly the same thought is implied in Psalm 34:21, where it says, "He guards all his bones, not one of them is broken." Certainly, it is implied in the imprecation frequently applied in rabbinic literature to such arch enemies of Israel as Nebuchadnezzar, Titus, and Hadrian, which says, Sechik Tamya, which means, may his bones be crushed. In other words, may he be denied all possibility of resurrection. Possibly, we may also find here the explanation of the extreme care with which, in ancient Israel, the bones of the dead were guarded and given proper burial. End quote. So why would the destruction of the bones then hinder resurrection? So much so that burning bones or destroying bones was basically like saying, I've just sent you to hell. Before we can address this, we must first recognize the significance of preserved bones for the purpose of the remembrance or memorial of a person after death. And as we've already seen in the Bible, bones are deeply connected to the lasting and honorable name and memory of a person. Removing their bones, burning their bones, destroying their bones is blotting out their memory from the earth. And if their bones are in the earth, especially in the land of their inheritance, in a sense, that's where they are. And the question would be, why is it so important for them to be there? Now, there's some hints and clues to this that we're going to get into. We're going to have to go on a little journey here. So, it is likely that the Hebrew word for bone, or bones, which is etzim, actually derives from the word for tree, which is etz. Now, this makes sense on a number of levels. I mean, if you think about it, the bones serve as these strong wood-like branches that hold up our flesh. But I think the connection goes deeper than this. Trees functioned quite significantly as memorials and signposts in ancient Israel, often in relation to burial sites, actually. For instance, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree once as a memorial for when he called on Yahweh. You can read about that in Genesis 21:33. And we also see throughout the Old Testament that oaks or terebinths are functioning as location markers, like in Genesis 12, Deuteronomy 11, Joshua 19, 1 Samuel 10, etc. There's a bunch of them. And it's possible, because they were so relatively easy to find, especially in a wilderness area, that oaks also featured prominently in religious and burial memorials. You can see this in Genesis 13, 35, Joshua 24, Judges 9, and there's a bunch. And it's very often that you find these terebinths or these oaks in idolatrous memorial practices. In fact, oftentimes the Asherah pole was a stump of a tree. And a lot of memorial pillars, actually, though most might have been of stone, were made from the stumps of trees or wooden pillars carved from once living trees. For instance, Absalom's pillar in the Valley of Kings, which he hoped would, quote, preserve his name in lieu of children or honorable burial, was probably from the stump of an oak. I say this because Isaiah uses that same Hebrew word to describe the, quote, stump of the remnant of Israel. Here's what he says. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump. The holy seed is its stump. Now, one of the features that's really interesting and why Isaiah uses this image is the terebinth oak is actually able to resurrect after it has been felled. It has the capacity to regrow strong trunk branches and renew a former life, even after being totally cut down. This object lesson and the connection that's already between bones and trees, like even at the word level, bones almost means trees. Etz is kind of a singular plural. It's used to refer both to plural and singular, kind of like deer. But Etzem is this weird pluralized version of tree that you don't even see anywhere else in the scriptures, but it's clearly connected to trees. I mean, it's probably the same word. And this connection, this object lesson, offers a powerful rationale for selecting terebinth oak groves as sites for family tombs where you're going to put people's bones. And though we often overlook it, we actually find this to be the case. There are the famous oaks, the oaks of Mamre, which existed near the family tomb of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which you can see in Genesis 13 and also Genesis 23. And then there's another grove of oaks, terebinth oaks, the oaks of Moreh, which flourished near Shechem, which is the burial place of Joseph's bones. And the bones then, kind of like a cut down oak or terebinth, represented the stump of a person. And it was able to spring to new life as long as the roots in the land were preserved. Do you see the connection? Life comes from the bones, most literally because life is in the blood and blood is produced in the bones. And so the bones of a person then represent this lasting memorial of that person in the land, their honorable name free from the corruptions of sinful flesh, and the lasting seed from which new life will spring in the land of promise. Really makes a lot of sense, actually. So bringing it full circle, we can return to our initial question with greater clarity. Given the fact that Joseph was one of the most spotless and holy of all the patriarchs, deserving of the greatest of all honors in burial, and understanding that his sons did wait for almost 200 years and went to great pains to take his bones all the way to Canaan on oath, why didn't they finish their task and bury Joseph with his fathers? Shouldn't they have gathered his bones to his fathers in the family tomb at Hebron? They could have. Why did they bury his bones in Shechem? Now, this geographical fact holds the key to understanding the grand significance of Joseph's burial. In close parallel to the burial of Joseph, the closing passage of the book of Joshua recounts Eleazar being buried in the hill of his son, Phinehas. Now, what's going on there? Has the whole system of honorable burial just been turned on its head? Since when do fathers get gathered to their sons? Well, Joseph's burial in the inheritance of his great-grandson Joshua in the land of Ephraim, coupled with the similar reversal of regular funeral rites for Eleazar, indicates that Israelite history has reached a major turning point. For nearly 200 years, Joseph had been looking back to where he came from. When last he had been in Shechem, he was betrayed by his brothers. They told his father he had been torn limb from limb by a wild animal. No honorable burial. This is why, when asked, Jacob and the scheming sons do not say Joseph has died, but rather they say Joseph is no more. He doesn't even exist anymore. He doesn't have bones anywhere. He's been eaten by wild animals. But when God brought Joseph out of Egypt with the Israelites under Moses and Joshua, Joseph then was able to enter his rest by faith. But his rest was not in the past, and in deeds which had already been accomplished, or in promises that had already been given but not yet fulfilled. His rest now awaited him in his sons, in the holy seed. As the exilic prophets made clear, the inheritance of the patriarchs depended to a great degree on the faithfulness of their descendants, the remnant. If the sons were unfaithful, the fathers also could be disinherited from their land by being cast from their tombs and having their bones exhumed. They deserved, in some way, to be disinherited, in fact. Their unbroken bones waited on the perfect substitutionary lamb of Passover, in whom they would finally have their full inheritance. The final rest and peace of the fathers depends on the faithfulness of the true seed of Abraham. So just as Joseph rested near the sanctuary city of Shechem, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob rested near the sanctuary city of Hebron, Jesus, the perfect Joshua, dwelled near the sanctuary city of Kadesh in Galilee, the only sanctuary city of Israel's major three not yet to be visited by the bones of a patriarch. Jesus grew up in Nazareth, from Netzar, meaning shoot or branch. Himself the accepted branch, the shoot of Jesse, from the stump of the holy seed, and the true resurrection. He is the life in the contents of the ark, literally the coffin, of the memorial, the word that enlivens the limed stone of the testimony, the living bread from heaven, and the blossom of the dead wood of Aaron. He hung cursed, like David's other son Absalom, but the tree he hung on became the tree of life, and his body is its fruit. He overcame the curse. His tomb was unsealed before his honorable secondary burial could take place, because his flesh would not see corruption and his bones remained unbroken. By faith, Joseph looked forward to him and the inheritance of life and spiritual flesh his bones would gain again in the fulfilled promises of the true and final Joshua. Finally, there would be one to give the land and its bones rest forever in an everlasting name above all names. Well, I told you this was going to be a bit of a weird one. Thanks for listening. If you want to talk to me about this episode or any of my other episodes, just please go to my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com, and post your comments or thoughts there on the relevant episode. I make a point of responding to every one of you as soon as I can. Also, I could really use your support on Patreon. I want to share freely what God has shared freely with me, and that's what I'm trying to do here on this podcast. But if you want to help me to do that by supporting me financially out of the generosity of your heart, please do so at the link to my Patreon in the show notes. For as little as $60 a year, that's just $5 a month, you can support me and my family while I work to make complex information more accessible to the sincerely curious within the superstructure of biblical truth. We are very grateful to those of you who have partnered with us to make this work more sustainable. I'm doing my best to make your investment in me worthwhile, and I really appreciate all of you that are helping and encouraging so much to make this podcast possible. Until next time.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.